gentlemen. The winner has unfortunately been announced, and it's not me. It's James Frey. And I must say he's a deserving winner. Since you had a challenge earlier about which included the word Baltimore, I thought I'd begin by reading a poem about Baltimore. So here it goes. It's called Winter Holiday. A bad tooth struggles out of a green sea, Baltimore, November 97. And I want to tell you something about water, not knowing exactly what anyone can say about it anymore. I want to talk about you. Two boats pair trawling a mile out, lost to the land. The sea swallows their engine noises. The surge of the wave along the rocks is rapids. A maelstrom, see how it liquidates what was rock. I want to talk about you. A baby seal head moons black eyes at us in the grey line where the spindrift churns off the cliff, wondering where all the mackerel have gone. Nets and gins and everything that holds us holds him. I want to talk about you. Talk is cheap. So sit by me and look out there. The curve we call the end of the earth is 5 miles away. If it is the end of the earth, I want to hold your hand and say something about this black rock and green sea. I want to talk about you. I'm more used to reading prose, and it's much easier to organize a prose reading. You know, you pick a piece, you time it, and it's 15 or 20 minutes. You have to waffle for 10 minutes or something, and then that's it, you know. Poetry is much more complicated, and I'd forgotten how complicated it was, because you've got these little snippets of poems that are, you know, 30 seconds, 45 seconds, and you have to add them all up, and you're adding in minutes and hours. So it's no fun. I decided anyway that having thought about lots and lots of different ways of organizing the reading, I decided that I would organize it in chronological order, so in order of the books. So I'm going to begin with a couple of poems from my first collection, Mathematics and Other Poems, which was published by Con Collins as here in Cork in a kind of a roundabout group, which I won't go into today, but which involved all sorts of collapses of publishing houses before that. Since then, I've often spoken to Con about it, and last time I spoke about it, he said, "Remind me never to publish a poetry collection again." And he hasn't, in fact, you know. So I'm going to read from the title selection a few of the pieces from the title selection. One thing that amazed me some time ago when I went back to look at my notebooks about this is that the way I had organized these poems was much more like how I organize them now, which is more random, more thrown together, or at least with the feeling of being thrown together. But because I was afraid that nobody would publish stuff like that, I reorganized them and re-edited them and reshaped them. And it's full of sonnet sequences as a result, you know. Some of which are, I think I could still stand over, and some of which I think definitely not. But anyway, I'm going to read three that I think I can still stand over. My wife was doing, Liz here, was doing a master's in mathematics at the time. And we more or less talk about everything. And my mathematics stopped really at the point at which they introduced letters. I felt it was an injustice, you know. Letters don't belong with numbers. In particular, X and Y, I think, had a special place in the alphabet. And so I kind of got into mathematics at more theoretical level, let's say, you know. When Liz was doing her master's. And so these poems are really about concepts in mathematics, which I don't understand. It begins with a quotation from Bertrand Russell, who else, of course, "Mathematics possesses not only truth, but supreme beauty, a beauty cold and austere like that of a sculpture." So So one of my aims in this was to actually prove that's not true. Insects. And also, by the way, I chose these points following on the Bad Sex Award. You'll see why. Insects. Drawn by the window light, two insects, contraptions of wire and glass, perform Euclidean love. We are safe to assume they have arrived at these positions from first principles, ab ovo, so to speak, or at least without the benefit of the Kama Sutra. Nature beggars the imagination in so many unexpected ways. While we are aground solidly on the bed, leviathans making token gestures with our tails. So where is your Euclid now, my love, whose elegant proposals postulate the perfect forms by laying on of lines? Butterfly. The caterpillar is all belly, but the butterfly is obsessed by sex. The chaotic flight is a safari of painted ladies, a random hoary weariness. Then she lays her down in dust, the shuddering and the symmetric wings, and drops her million peppery seeds to probe with fetal hands and eat and die. Each life is built on the last simple addition of bulk and belly until the ultimate appearance of order and symmetry in the butterfly's wings. The series has no meaning, a pattern of recurrence. Each term is appetite. And of course, despite the kind of sex that goes on with Bad Sex Award, sex very often results in pregnancy. Astronaut. Especially in Ireland in those days when you didn't have any option, you know. Astronaut. Well, what is it like to have a baby? The mirror frosts around your O's and sends you back pale light of hair, the highlight and glassy shadows. Your stippled flanks love lighting every ripple, and you pirouette. In the reach, a fish rolls in gracious arc. Put out your nets, the seas are full. The body is water, a baby spacewalks in a frictionless aquarium in the moon. He is practicing to be an astronaut. His head is too big to be born. It is a helmet he must remove. He will emerge with it under his arm, waving like Gagarin. I don't know if you know who Gagarin was. First man in space. And the other thing about that is that but it came as a surprise to me, when a baby is born, his head is too big to be born, but there's a division in the skull which compresses in the birth canal, which is, I think, a most amazing thing. Exactly, but man.
There's a word for next week, no?
January. So this is from my second collection, Fahrenheit Says Nothing to Me, which takes, this is the title poem. Wittgenstein, I studied philosophy at university, and Wittgenstein was one of the many philosophers that I can safely say I did not understand. But there was one item in the Philosophical Investigations, which I did get. He said, "I am not used to measuring temperature on the Fahrenheit scale. Hence, such a measure of temperature says nothing to me." So this poem is called Fahrenheit Says Nothing to Me. Me too, Ludwig. And the following also. The dogs in the street who know things say nothing to me. Tarot cards, tea leaves, economists, pictures give me 1,000 words any day. For certain reasons, I have trouble with res ipsa loquitur and the sworn testimony of a superintendent. Government press statements, the Irish Independent, the income returns of publicans, the pro-life movement, toilet humor, soccer, Daddy Bush and Baby Bush, Black Bush and the Burning Bush, Ronald Reagan and Donald Duck, Mind, Body, Spirit, and the Great American Novel, and American Movies Say Nothing to Me. The Queen of England, her heirs and successors, and her so-called court, and Philip Larkin Say Nothing to Me. Banks, insurance companies, pension funds, right-of-way and roundabouts, cats, turnips, and Jehovah's Witnesses Do Not Speak to Me. Women's tights, e-books, tongue rings do not speak, or navel rings, labia rings, the ring of confidence and the ring of bright water, and the paedophile ring, Sky News and the ticker tape at the bottom, the Nike swoosh and the bent toothbrush, and the Fahrenheit scale Say Nothing to Me. One of the things about reading poems is that they're kind of temporally defined, you know? And I was wondering, actually, when I was playing this last week, if anybody would get the reference to Bush, but of course, Daddy Bush just died, you know? So he's in the news. But this book came out at around the time of the Iraq War, the Second Iraq War, George W. Bush's Iraq War. And so this poem is called The Shield Maker. And it's subtitled On the Eve of War 2003. I'm thinking of, that concept of ekphrasis of kind of describing something which is painted or whatever. And it comes from Achilles, Shield of Achilles, originally. So, the Shield Maker. We may say, he made also a great fallow field, large and three times over ploughed already. Laborers he made there, and ploughboys turning their horses up and down, furrow by furrow. And the ploughed land was dark behind them, though the field was of gold. I was thinking there particularly of what eventually happened, of the destruction of the kind of cultural heritage of Iraq and so on like that. I mean, I didn't know it was going to happen, but I think everybody was predicting it would happen, and lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. This is my third collection, Ghost Estate. And I'm going to begin with the title poem, which suffered the indignity of being not only on the Leaving Cert course a few years ago, but being on the actual Leaving Cert exam. And I was a teacher, and I know what that indignity means. By this time, it takes me about 7 years to write a collection of poetry. So by this time, the crash had happened, and you know, I don't need to tell you. After the crash, we had 320,000 empty houses, and we had about 100,000 people on the housing waiting list. But you couldn't give the 320,000 houses to the 100,000 people on the waiting list because it would disturb the market. And so we still have problems that we have, including the homeless problem, which is getting worse in actual fact. My thinking about this poem was that the people who created what we now call the Irish Revolution would probably have put the people running the country up against the wall and shot them for doing what they did at that time, you know. But, you know, there's that phrase of the First and Second Republic in France, the Third Republic and so on. And I feel the First Republic in Ireland ended with the crash. Ghost Estate. Oh, the refrain in this, by the way, comes from a piece of advertising that I used to see driving, I can't remember exactly where now, I think it was in Waterford. So that's where their fame comes from. Women inherit the ghost estate. Their unborn children play invisible games of hide and seek in the scaffold frames. If you lived here, you'd be home by now. They fear winter and the missing lights on the unmade road and who they will get for neighbours if anyone comes anymore. If you lived here, you'd be home by now. The saurian cranes and concrete mixers, the rain graying onto the hardcore, and the wind in the empty windows. If you lived here, you'd be home by now. The heart is open plan, wired for alarm. But we never thought we'd end like this, the whole country a builder's tip. If you lived here, you'd be home by now. It's all over now but to fill the holes, nowhere to go. And out on the edge where the boys drive too fast for the road, that old sign says, first phase sold out. To lighten the mood slightly, and to follow on the theme of the Bad Sex Award, of course, this is called The Property Developer's Wet Dream. And I apologise, my son, I wrote this poem because my son at one stage was a temporary postman in the Douglas area, so I apologise to anybody who happens to be living in Douglas in advance. The Property Developer's Wet Dream. I dreamed I was driving a compressor through Amberley, Ashley, Hazeldene, Kenley, Berkeley, Willowmere, Castle Treasure, Bellevue, Heather Lawn, Heather Crescent, Ashley Mount, Hunter's Way, Kingsway, Wellwyn Way, the paddocks, Hazeldene Close, Windham Close, Ashley Close, Brierley, Kensington Downs, Ensley.
You can see I deserve to win.
This one is called We Imagine the Police. We imagine the police cameras catching other people doing things that irritate us in their cars. This is the police state of mind, and we are sensible citizens of the common sense as we shop in the late evening in the supermarket that never closes, not even for God. And we try to remember what we want. And we try to buy only what we need. And desire keeps getting in the way. We genuflect before other people's shopping in aisles sacred to the memory of home cooking and detergent and the kind of things your mother baked. And as we are occasionally electrocuted by the metal, we begin to believe that bread belongs to today, that there are different qualities of white, that there are no preservatives, that the meat is prime and the supermarket cares for us, and that every little helps. It is chip and pin in the late evening under the watchful eyes. We imagine people using our cards to buy things we would never buy in places we have never been on a day or days without our express permission. This is the police state of mind. As we drive home in the night with a car full of things we scarcely believe are real, our past haunted by kitchen paper rolls, cans of asparagus tips, stick and click LED lights, mosquito candles, in case we get global warming soon, disposable barbecues, fruit psychosis and probiotic yogurt, and canned salmonella and thawing petit pois, and lawn weed and feed, and a nest box, and a special kind of notepaper that has forget-me-nots, and a memory stick, and a device for opening reluctant cardboard cartons, and a fold-up tent for when we fold our tent, and a wallet full of promises that there will still be shopping, no matter how dark the time. In the dark times will there be singing? Yes, there will be singing about the dark times. That's Bertolt Brecht. And then this is a poem you probably remember. Well, you probably don't remember it, most of you people are younger than me, but the introduction of the ban on liquids on flying. I remember it acutely because I missed a flight because of it. And of course it followed on all sorts of other things. But this is a poem dedicated to a friend of mine, a Portuguese writer, who read here in Cork actually many years ago. It's called Flight. I missed the flight because of the terror alert that has terrified everyone. I had some liquid in my pocket that they thought might be explosive. Just the artificial tears I'd begun to use, because they come easier and less painfully. And while I waited for my tears to be decommissioned, the other passengers said, who would think of taking tears on a journey during the war on terror? And where did I think I was going? And who would I use them on? How are we doing for time? I have no idea.
I'm grand.
Yeah. Okay. So this is the Yellow House, the most recent collection. It's probably, I've been working for years to try to find a way to write about politics. I read a lot of political theory and so on. And I'm not sure I found the right way yet, but I'm definitely making my way with this book closer to what I want to do. So I want to read a few poems from it. The first is called The Ballad of the Cromley Coat, and some of you may remember this episode. You probably know also that once you become a minister of government in Ireland, it's obligatory that you wear a Cromley coat. A minister, a government minister, in a country not far, set out one night on a quest with his armed police guard and his trusty PR in search of the people, the homeless people, on a pilgrimage of grace and the press. And to do good, surely, said Jonathan Corry. And he looked on the doorsteps of the big corporations, marble and glass and underfloor heating, and he knew them already. He goes by the front door. And there he found people, more or less homeless people. Sure, we're sleeping in doorways, said Jonathan Corry. They were sleeping on cardboard, soup from the Simon, a winter's night, and bitter at that, the wind on the river dying, a promise of frost, and the minister wore Cromley, hands in his pockets. Who could blame him? Not me, surely, said Jonathan Corry. Oh, a young man gone in the head, died in a doorway of a cold night, not the same night, and not the same doorway. And people brought flowers, they that never brought flowers the 20-odd years he was dying. No worries. But look, I could do with the Cromby, said Jonathan Corry. You get interviewed. Not so much when you publish poetry, but when you publish novels, people interview you. I don't know why there's a difference, but there is. And you get asked some most stupid questions at times, you know. I've been interviewed by people for health problems, for example, like bad health, you know. And you can get asked really insane questions. So this is a poem called On Being Interviewed. Do I worry that the bank is in earthfall? That my life insurance is anal retentive? And that I won't be around to collect anyway. That entrepreneurs are unloved. That this is the country of big grudgery. Or that there is no respect for property. The short answer is no. Do I worry that the police are too gentle? That torturers feel left out of the Geneva Conventions? That avian flu is about to go terrestrial? That shoppers are afraid of closure? That organic may not always be? The short answer is no. Bird nesting is late this year. There are cameras on every street. My sons were beaten in London by the police. They want to sell our drinking water to some corporation of bastards. I get letters from people who don't know my name, but I'm dropped from the register of electors by mistake. Each year, 80,000 people emigrate. I am free to come or go because I'm white, blessed by the law and the police. Evictions proceed apace. Asymmetric war means more brown people die, but we only miss the white. We grieve for our dead, but not for our kills, our long-range terminal goodwill. And I'm supposed to have a short answer. The short answer is no. I read that in America last year, and it drew an absolute dead silence. I don't know why. This next poem is called the great course of individualism. You probably would agree with me that individualism is, you know, neoliberalism has kind of established individualism as the way in which we're supposed to relate to each other, as if that's possible, you know. And it has taken the place of whatever, social democracy maybe, or other forms of relating to each other, and has replaced solidarity. And, you know, we now end up with Donald Trump, for example, in England, Brexit, Michael Gove, and what's the name of that sort who looks like something from... Boris Johnson. I was thinking of the other guy. Rees-Mogg. Yeah, he looks like something from Harry Potter. So, you know, and in Italy, Salvini and Orban and all that kind of stuff. And probably Macron as well. So that's what happens. So that's what I think anyway. So this is called the Great Chorus of Individualism. In our suburban trailer parks, our caravanserai of permanent buildings and outhouses and public houses, our fixtures and fittings, our uprooted and fortified impermanency, our pastel shades and other troublesome shades, our futures and our children's futures and our contracts for difference, our tremulous faith in reserve, our 24-carat bankruptures, our infantile amnesia, we, the individuals, not the people, that troublesome spectre. We, the herd, but not the crowd. Teamwork, but not solidarity. Moving forward without movements. DIY tycoons and shareholders and placeholders. Endlessly repeating the static of our stasis on talk shows and dumb shows and no shows and phoning complaint hosting, as if it were an ontological proof that we, in our profound and articulate silence, our chattering night and day classes and self-improvement and self-storage, and our classless societies and private clubs, our spirituality and our charity and our philanthropy, our mindfulness competitions and our coffee mornings, and our bourgeois insensibilities, our givings and our takings and our float, our annual general morality, our accountancy, our whiter than whiteness, our Christian ledger and ledger domain, our feel-good factors and motor factors, and our conscientious subjections, and our social unconscious. We don't give a shit. We just don't go there. No, we just don't. You're very encouraging. I might go on at night. I spend a good deal of time in Italy, and I've spent a good deal of time in Italy, and I made friends with a group of writers who came here to read actually a few years ago. They were called Gruppo 77, Gruppo 77, from Bologna. And of course, the Italians are very like us. They've now split up, you know. Remember Brendan Behan said the first item on the agenda of any Irish political party is the split. And so they've split up now since, unfortunately. But one of the people who used to follow them in Bologna was a guy who owned a very small vineyard. And he brought us out there one day to, you know, just to show us the vineyard and drink wine and all that kind of stuff. And so this is a poem which is partly about that. But it's also about migration, which is something that I feel very strongly about. I mean, we just heard recently from the UN report that Africa, for example, has suffered more than any other continent under climate change. And anybody who thinks that migration is going to stop is mad. We're destroying the planet, and people are going to suffer, and they're going to come where things are better. And our best solution, I think anyway, is to open our borders and, you know, accept responsibility for what we've done, because it's our fault. But anyway, this is called Under the Olives. Here's red wine to toast the gods of olive groves and vineyards, talking about weather, the little wet patch where the fly enters the olive and drinks the oil, a 30% loss. And I thought of my father complaining of rain or no rain on the barley. Weather is a lingua franca, but the rate of exchange varies. Sun is cheap here, even in October, and in the country where your workers left to save your harvest, the sun is debt unredeemable, 1,000 years without rain. Wives and children wait for the remittance. You work to earn, we work to eat, he said. Away over the hills of Imola, kestrels hang and clouds darken below the Tuscan border, the long history of coming up from the south to a stony welcome. And the olive is bitter as it hangs, the little black fruit smaller and sharper than a sloe, and a storm in the heart, the seed never to be set. I don't want to go into politics up really, but I mean, I think Italy has been very badly served by the European Union, and the result is that we have these Salvinian people like that in power now, you know. That's not going to be any fun. Just a couple of things here. Lampedusa, in case you don't know, is an island between between Sicily and Tunisia, closer to Tunisia, but it's Italian. And it was, still is really, one of the first reception points for refugees trying to cross the Mediterranean. It has, thousands and thousands of people living there now, whereas before it had hundreds. I wrote this poem at the time that Alexis Tsipras in Greece was trying to get Greek debt restructured and to change the way in which people kind of dealt with debt. And if you remember, he came up against a guy called Wolfgang Schäuble of the Bundesbank in Germany, who really dominated the European fiscal responses to him at that stage, you know. And I wrote this in Sicily. And the other thing to remember about Sicily is that Sicily has been home to countless different civilizations. Some indigenous civilization that was there first. The Greeks came along. The Moors came. The British came. I'm trying to think of others. There are numerous. I mean, the Spanish at one point. There were numerous civilizations there. Who?
Phoenicians.
Exactly, the Phoenicians, exactly, yeah. So, you know, on and on Sicily has been now, and my our good friend in Sicily, her name is Concetta Mazzullo, and Mazzullo is an Arabic name. So sometime in the 14th century or 15th century, she thinks her family was Arabic. So it's a society which has always been a kind of a melting pot. So that's kind of the background to the poem. A lot of these poems are called The Ballad Of, and this is called The Ballad of Lampedusa. A cold storm throws foam and stones. I should also say a grecale is a wind from the east. It blows directly from Greece to Sicily, and it's a cold wind because it comes off the mountains of Greece, which are at that time of the year cold. This is kind of early March. A cold storm throws foam and stones on the coast of Sicily. A grecale blows, nothing to hinder it between here and the Peloponnese. And I sit by a window translating a poem about people drowning halfway to Africa, almost in Tunisia, in Lampedusa. Geography is indeed a destiny. That waterless rock, those warm seas, the dead come ashore like drowned birds halfway to Africa in Lampedusa. The oil black flotsam of my childhood, gannets and gulls clogged and crude. the rainbow slick under a summer sun. Europe is a prison, not a fortress. We know it now, we who chose it. Here on the old Greek shore, or halfway to Africa in Lampedusa. An old storm tumbles us onto a stony road. The dim light of a house has no welcome. What language do they speak? What angry or timorous gods, by what secret or social code do they greet poor strangers? Halfway from Africa, in Lampedusa. I met a man from Senegal. He came the good way, he said. He sold small animals of wood and the toys of another world in which children play with things our children throw away. And he did calculus on a table napkin to prove he had a right to be halfway from Africa, almost in Europe, in Lampedusa. Dear friends, our hearts are cold. 200 years of the rights of man, what once was Europe, broke on the Bundesbank. As this storm breaks on Etna's ancient lava, it must be cold in Greece now. This wind falling from the white head of Olympus chills our old future. Everything is different today. No more dreams of Arcady. We are so far from Africa, from Lampedusa.
Okay. In that case, I'll read the last one.
This is bad sex.
This is a little bit long. It's about 5 minutes. Is that all right?
Yes.
5 minutes, okay? All right. Okay, just a very brief introduction. I was born, or at least I was born in Cork, actually, but I grew up in the village of Whitegate, just down the harbour. And, my parents died and the house was sold and so on like that. But it was still, if you like, kind of a memory of the family home. And one day I was going down to visit my parents' grave, and I looked at where the house should be, and it was gone. In the meantime, it had blown up, literally blown up. And this is my attempt to kind of come to terms with the fact that outside of wartime, somebody blew up our house. And the answer is in the poem as well. It almost destroyed the village of Whitegate in the process, by the way, and almost killed a number of people. It's called The Yellow House. Title poem again. Someone blew up the yellow house. It was no surprise. It should happen to everyone. The past is an animal, burrowing inside out. Yesterday it was autumn and the kingdom of bank managers. They were kings in waiting, and someone blew up the house where I grew up. Yesterday there were leaves on the street and people coming and going as if there were places, origins and destinations. And love was yesterday in the way that childhood was yesterday. And all that stuff about our fellow man, and today is for the kindness of markets, regrets and dividends. Someone blew up the yellow house. A fag end was the charge, light of my life, in which everyone died except me. The sea comes and goes at the door, bringing rats and uncles, sailors at a jaunty angle, and occasionally ants to the yellow house. Trouble, trouble. My father leaves early and works late all that summer, potatoes and saving the hay, and anything else he can think of, mending fences, taking the horse to water. In those days there were horses, and nothing of the world impresses me so much as the size of my aunt's suitcase. And the huge variety of clothes it contains that she never wears, because whatever we have, we wear it all. And when she goes, she leaves some that my mother never wears, some kind of surplus in the yellow house, like the way my father never ploughs the headlands, but never leaves them to seed either, and how they ache in broken mud in summer. And my uncle comes, after a rough crossing, 1939 to 45, He was a mutineer at Invergordon when the Navy rose, an always bulgy boy coming home to die with a brown suitcase. And die he did as they are wont to do. Snuffed it in terrible pain or oblivion, depending on where you say the man ended and the pain began. And he was a ladies' man, often married, never churched. He lifted his hat, good morning, ma'am. Evenings too, on his way to the pub would steam up, getting his chemo from a pint glass and a short. Fire below, Bill Boy, bloody boiler is blown, it's Davy Jones for me. Oh, Davy Jones. This room is full of dead people, my father said to me. In the hospital ward, we were alone. I saw fear where his valium should be. His father died of anemia when he was 12 years old. The graves of Corkbeg and the Hadda, the names of the long gone people he sold cattle to in the prehistory of then. His comical watching empty places, his finger pointing. The doctors moved like thunder to cancel the numinous and new prescription. And the dead went down like Christians into the holes assigned. And my father in the land of the living held his ground and took his time, whistling and crying and longing for the day. And we brought him home to the Yellow House. My father hoisted me onto his shoulders when I could walk no more. We were going into the long hours before lights, and we were beyond lights anyway. It was one of those times before memory, the way behind us already fading to black, the beginning of things or the end of beginnings, with hours to cockcrow and all that goes that road. And the time came when we exchanged places, handy-dandy, me for him and him for me, and I carried him to his grave on my foolish shoulders, the way behind us fading to black, the hour of cockcrow and all that goes that road. And my mother, never a big eater after my father died, starved herself to death for lonesomeness, a seamstress and a natty dresser, she wore high collars, loved the Yellow House. Oh, love was yesterday in the way time was yesterday. So much pain, the last thing she said, or the last thing I remember. She went out like a light, unstitched her life, travelling, fingers unwinding, winding sheets, picking at clothes, unpicking the fabric of the world until only the bones remain. They had bones and collars then, and stiffer backs, but they bent and broke together, bent and broke together. And desolation's settlement came to the Yellow House. Down there, at the fractal edge of knowing water and world, I passed on the road to my parents' grave and saw nothing where the house should be. A development opportunity, a gap in the teeth of the rising gale, a shock to the system. Windows like gun bays, creaking doors, switches my father fitted upside down, never to be thrown again. A whole roof of clean slates, a cast iron kitchen range and timber wainscoting, now air and angels, all that was once a Yellow House. The past is a cracker, a Catherine wheel, a bomb in the best of places, a mine in the heart. Here is the truth, a store of bottled gas, a perfect bomb, and someone tossed a fag end or a match, that casual aplomb, and boom, someone blew up the Yellow House.
Can we get a big round of applause again for William Wallace?